All right, several weeks ago, we went through 1 Kings, which includes the reign of Solomon. So instead of continuing on to 2 Kings, we're looking at what Solomon wrote in our Bible. We already looked at Proverbs a couple weeks ago. So this week, that brings us to Ecclesiastes, which is probably the hardest book I've had to summarize so far. Not an easy book to deal with. But as far as the author of Ecclesiastes in chapter 1, verse 1, this is how he's introduced. This is the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. So he calls himself the teacher, or can also be translated as preacher or leader of the assembly. Basically, someone who has called people together to instruct them. He refers to himself as son of David, king in Jerusalem. That would seem to mean Solomon. Some people have proposed that maybe it's a different descendant of David, king in Jerusalem. But we're pretty sure it's Solomon. Chapter 1, verse 16 talks about him being extremely wise. It says, I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. If you go down into chapter 2, a further description of his greatness also tends to match Solomon as kind of the golden age of Israel. Where it says, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasures of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well. The delights of man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. And all of this, my wisdom stayed with me. That sounds like Solomon. So we're going to go with the assumption that this is Solomon. A few people, some scholars have tried to argue for a later writer, or at least a later editor, based on the vocabulary and style of the book, but their arguments aren't very strong, so we're going to assume that it was Solomon that wrote this. As far as the subject matter on this, this is what makes it one of the harder books to get through. The subject matter is, what is the point, or what is the meaning of life? And this is a difficult book, because at first glance, it seems to endorse some rather ungodly viewpoints. It's one of those that maybe the first time you read it, you go, does God know this book is in here? Because I'm not sure it should be. Because it almost seems to say that life is completely meaningless and absurd, that morality is pointless, and that when you're dead, you're dead. That's a philosophy that we call nihilism. It's around. The most famous person that came up with that expounded upon is a man named Nietzsche, a very bad man. It might also seem to say, you know, eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. In other words, you might as well live for pleasure to some degree or another. And that would be the philosophy of the Epicureans or the hedonists. And you know what? Most of what Solomon says does seem to contain the sort of pessimism that you find in these philosophies. But what Solomon has to say is not quite as bleak as these two philosophies, because they basically come up with, when you're dead, you're dead. This life is all there is. It's really quite pointless. Some nihilists even say you might as well commit suicide. Though you notice that the people who say that seldom go on to commit suicide and say they collect royalties from the books they've written. But Solomon fully recognizes and is painfully honest about the brokenness of this world, the inevitability of death, and the finality of death from the human perspective. You know, from our perspective, that's the end. However, his final perspective includes God, which makes his conclusions different from these ungodly philosophies. And there are 4 main words or phrases that Solomon returns to over and over throughout the book. And the first one is meaningless, or also often translated vanity or vain, futile or futility. Also has the idea of kind of a vapor that's there and then blown away. And and he also repeatedly refers to it as chasing after the wind, something that's worthless. You know, the sample reference for this and kind of the subject verse of the whole book is chapter 1 and verse 2. It says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. There's a way to start a sermon, huh? So that's a phrase and an idea that's going to get repeated over and over and over again throughout this book. But a closely associated phrase with it is under the sun. And this is the perspective from which all things appear to be meaningless. This is the perspective of what humans can observe and experience in this world. You could almost refer to it as the scientific point of view. It emphasizes what he can see and what he can conclude from what he has seen, you know, purely based on observation. So it doesn't speculate on anything beyond what is observable. That's the point of view from which all things are meaningless. A couple of sample references that use that phrase under the sun. Chapter 1, verse 9 says, "What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun." And the longer you're around or the more history you read, the more true you realize that is. Same chapter, verse 14, another verse that uses the same phrase. "I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." So there we have two of our phrases, under the sun and meaningless. A third phrase or word that comes up actually quite a bit is enjoyment or enjoy. Which is not what you'd expect in a book that sounds as pessimistic as this one does so far. But there are a number of exhortations throughout the book to enjoy life here and now. Now, these admonitions are usually followed by reminders that death is inevitable or by reminders that life is meaningless. So it kind of doesn't, you know, not as encouraging as you would think at first listen. But an example of that would be chapter 8 and verse 15. Be one place where he talks about enjoyment. And there he says, "So I commend the enjoyment of life, because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun." Another example, and this one a little more in your face maybe, is chapter 9, verse 9, where he says, "Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love. All the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labors under the sun." Well, thanks, Solomon. We all feel better now, right? But he does use this word enjoyment. He just happens to usually balance it out with meaninglessness. The fourth phrase that he uses, not quite as many times, but it's probably the most important phrase, and it does occur numerous times throughout the book, is to fear God. Because life under the sun, this observable life that we're living right now, is not all that there is. Life ultimately derives its meaning from God, and I'm giving you spoilers for the end of the book. But some sample references to the fear of God. Chapter 3 and verse 14. Says, "I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him." Similarly, over in chapter 8, verses 12 through 13. It says, "Although a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time, I know that it will go better with those who fear God, who are reverent before him. Yet because the wicked do not fear God, it will not go well with them, and their days will not lengthen like a shadow." So this idea of fearing God is repeated multiple times throughout the book, and it's going to be the big conclusion of the book as well. So, again, spoilers for the end. But even the fear of God is not a nice pat answer that ties up all the loose ends in a pretty bow and helps us to understand everything. But it is where Solomon is going to end up, and it is what keeps Solomon from being as pessimistic as other people who hold similar views. As far as the structure of the book, there's very little agreement of how the ideas in the book and how the organization of the book flows, how the argument flows, or if there even is much of a flow at all. So we're going to just go through and touch on the main points a chapter or two at a time without trying to impose some kind of strict structure on the book. It's more structured than Proverbs, but it's still a little bit loosely structured. And like I said, every commentary you look at is going to have a different structure for the book. So we're just going to look at it chapter two at a time. And something to remember as we go through this is that as church age believers who have the New Testament, we have a lot more revelation from God than Solomon had. Solomon has Genesis through Deuteronomy. He might have 1 and 2 Samuel, might have Joshua, Judges, Ruth, depending on who wrote them. He has some of his father's psalms, but that's about it. You know, and most of what we know about life after death, about the resurrection and so forth, comes later than Solomon. Now, Old Testament saints, including people before Solomon, did have beliefs about being with God forever. Psalm 23 ends, "Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." When we looked at Job, we saw that Job even seems to have some sort of idea about a future resurrection in some of what he says in Job 19, verses 26 and 27. It says, "And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I and not another, how my heart yearns within me." So there are ideas in the Old Testament of a resurrection, of life after death, but they are not well defined. And Solomon is not going to talk a lot about it. In fact, Solomon's perspective, for the most part, is what we already said, is that under the sun. It's what can be observed and experienced in this lifetime, is where he's coming from. So, given that, we'll start through this very odd book. So chapter 1, the main point of chapter 1 is that a lot of things are meaningless. And I'm going to do a lot of summary down through here. You can go back and actually look at the verses later. This is a wisdom and poetry book, so a lot of the thoughts in it are expressed very poetically, so you can go back and read that on your own time, but we're only going to look at a few verses. I'm going to do a lot of summarizing. But chapter 1 talks about things that are meaningless. And verses 2 through 11 give us the theme of basically the whole book. And that theme is that all human endeavor is pointless. All human endeavor is meaningless. That individuals come and go and are forgotten, and things on earth just continue basically as they've always been. And then he starts listing a variety of things that are meaningless. Verses 12 through 18, he comes right out and says that wisdom in and of itself is ultimately meaningless. And that having a lot of wisdom doesn't give life purpose or enable you to fix everything that's wrong. And he even goes so far as to say that the more wisdom you have, sometimes the worse off you are. I think because the more you realize how broken and messed up things are and how little we can do about them in the big scheme of things. So his conclusion in the second half of chapter 1 is that wisdom is meaningless, is vanity. Chapter 2. He continues on with the same thing and lists some more things that are meaningless. And verses 1 through 11, he talks about how a life lived for pleasure, wealth, and accomplishments is meaningless. I already read you a section out of that as he was describing his own wealth and prestige. You know, and Solomon would know. Solomon was the king of Israel at the absolute peak of its power and wealth. Solomon could and did have any experience and any possession that he desired. And in the end, looking back at his life, and by the way, this is probably one of the last things that Ecclesiastes is probably one of the last things that Solomon wrote. This is Solomon looking back on his life. He realizes that he didn't really have anything of set lasting, satisfying value. That was all meaningless. Verses 12 through 16, he kind of returns to the idea that a life lived in wisdom is to some extent meaningless. He does point out that wisdom is better than folly. He says that it's like living in light versus living in darkness. So in that sense, wisdom is good. But he wraps up the section of verse 16 by saying that, you know what, the wise and the fool share the same fate. They both die. So from a perspective of purely physical observation under the sun, a life of wisdom ends the same for everyone, so it's meaningless. Verses 17 to 24, he says, a life of hard work is meaningless. That in the end, it's going to benefit someone else who might be a good, nice, righteous person, wise person like you, or they might just as likely be a wicked, foolish person, and they're going to get the benefit of your work. And he does point out in verses 24 through 26 that a righteous person can find enjoyment in their work, that enjoyment is a gift from God. But that it doesn't really give meaning to life. chapter 3, he shifts gears a little bit. He stops listing things that are meaningless, at least for a little while. And he talks about how God is in control of all things. In verses 1 through 8, he talks about how God makes everything happen at the right time. And if you read those verses, you'll recognize a song that occasionally plays on the oldies radio station. And if it's stuck in your head now, you're welcome. in verses 9 through 15, he mentions that there is wisdom and enjoyment that come from doing God's will. Because God is going to accomplish his will in the world. So, you know, as I said just last couple Sundays, you're going to have a whole lot more blessings in life if you go along with his will than if you're dragged kicking and screaming along. So there is an enjoyment that comes with that. But in verses 16 to 22, he points out that even God's judgment sometimes, from an under-the-sun perspective, seems meaningless, seems pointless. Because even though wicked, he says that even though wickedness often prevails for a time, God does judge. But then he says, but everyone eventually dies and returns to dust, just like animals. And there's no way to tell whether our spirits fare any different than theirs do. And again, this is him speaking from a under-the-sun, scientific observation kind of perspective. So he says, in the end, what does it mean if God judges because everyone dies? Well, chapter 4, he gets extra pessimistic and takes some time to talk about how the world is just full of oppression and injustice. He does lighten it up a little bit by talking about how companionship and wisdom and contentment can bring enjoyment, how they are better than wealth and power. There's a lot in there about having a friend to come alongside you and to help you along life's path. Chapter 5 and 6 then kind of group together. Chapter 5, the first 7 verses, he returns to the theme of fearing God and living righteously. And if you're reading this for the first time, you're going, okay, finally, this actually sounds like something that belongs in the Bible. verses 1 through 7, he talks about being ready to learn rather than to speak. He contrasts those who go to God's presence to hear and to listen versus those who go to talk and to show off how much they know. And he talks about fulfilling your commitments, that if you make a commitment to God, you keep that commitment. He says it's better off to not vow than to vow and not keep. Well, from there, he goes back to talking about things that are meaningless. In 5, verse 7 down through about 6:12, he talks about how riches and honor are meaningless. And again, this he would know from experience. He was fabulously wealthy. He was honored by people far and wide. He had, you know, the Queen of Sheba coming from far away to come and listen to his wisdom and to marvel over it. And he lists several reasons why riches and honor are in the end meaningless. And the first is that those who have them always want more. And there's the story of the multi-millionaire or billionaire who was asked, how much more do you need? And just a little more. That's an observation that's been around a long time. Solomon said, people who have money, they just always want a little bit more. People who have a little bit of honor and power just always want a little bit more, a little bit more recognition, a little bit more authority, a little bit more money. It does not bring meaningfulness to a life. And he points out, again, you can't take it with you. Someone else is eventually going to benefit from what you've built up, whether it's a fortune or a power base or whatever it might be. Eventually, we all die. And you can't take it with you to the grave. Even if you get someone to chuck in your casket with you, it's just sitting there in the ground. And so his conclusion, again, is that's meaningless. But he wraps up this section by saying, you know, even though these things don't give life a point, that they are not the main meaning of life, he says we should enjoy them. We should enjoy what God has given us. And God wants us to enjoy what he has given us. But we also need to realize that those things are not what provides meaning in life. Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20 is that kind of wrap-up statement in that regard, where it says, this is what I've observed to be good. That it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, that is a gift of God. They seldom reflect on the days of their life because God keeps them occupied with gladness of heart. So he says, the good things that you have, yeah, this the fact that they aren't the point of life doesn't mean that you can't enjoy them. They are gifts from God. You know, these religions, including varieties of Christianity, that think that it's somehow holy to deny yourself enjoyment merely for the sake of denying yourself enjoyment. That's called asceticism, where you make yourself suffer just because apparently God likes us to suffer. That's not how God works. God, in his loving character, does give us things. He wants us to enjoy them. He created this universe for us to live in and enjoy. So Solomon says, yeah, even though these things do not give life its meaning, they are gifts from God. They are things that we can enjoy. Chapter 7 and 8 then have kind of another shift in tone, and he talks about wisdom and righteousness. And again, this is a section that sounds more like what we're used to hearing in the Bible a little bit. It sounds a lot like the book of Proverbs. A number of short sayings, maybe a little bit longer than the one in Proverbs, but a number of short sayings about how that contain that contain advice on wise living, advice on how the world usually works. There's, given the nature of the book, there's quite a bit of emphasis on sin and difficulty in the world, more than you'll find maybe in the book of Proverbs. But Solomon has now lived a long life and is looking back and sees how broken the world can be. And that's included in his advice. And among his observations in this section are that things generally go well for those who fear God, and they generally go poorly for those who do not. I mean, if you go to the book of Proverbs, that's kind of the theme of the book of Proverbs as well. Live this way in line with God's will, and your life is likely to be better than if you live foolishly any way you please. But again, because this is the book of Ecclesiastes, he ends the section with the observation that things don't always seem to turn out that way. That God's ways are, to some extent, incomprehensible. They're beyond our ability to grasp what he is doing in the world. Chapter 8, verse 17, he makes that point. He says, "Then I saw all that God had done. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it." And this is, you know, kind of a companion verse to that one in Isaiah where God says, you know, as high as the heavens are above the earth, so high are my thoughts above yours, so my ways above yours. Solomon says, yeah, even the wisest of us can't grasp exactly what God is doing in the world. We have these nice little proverbs that tell us how things usually work out, that God usually blesses the righteous, that God usually punishes the wicked. But we look around at the world and sometimes we go, I have no idea what God is doing right now. Ecclesiastes is just a very honest book. It's just Solomon looking around and saying, I just don't get it sometimes. I don't see the point. Chapter 9, he continues, talks about a variety of things, life, death, and wisdom. In verses 1 through 6, you get a cheery little section about how death comes for all of us. And that from our perspective, that under the sun perspective, death is the end. People don't come back once they die. They get put in the ground and they return to dust. He follows that up in verses 7 through 10 by telling people, well, you still need to enjoy the life that God has given you. And he lists things like food, a loving spouse, even some of the luxuries. He talks about being anointed with oil and clothed in white. But realize that those things, again, do not give meaning to life. If that is where you're seeking for your meaning, you're going to, in the end, come to the conclusion life is meaningless. And verses 11 through 18, he wraps that up with the observation that life is full of the unexpected, but that in his experience, wisdom is better than strength and foolishness. It is better to be wise than it is to be fast or strong and be a foolish person. Which goes into the next section of verses 10 and 11, or excuse me, chapters 10 and 11, which is another section of wise sayings. Again, it's a similar, that's very similar to Proverbs, even more so than chapters 7 and 8 are. He includes advice on a variety of topics, including how difficult life is, including the enjoyment of youth, enjoying things while you're young, but again, emphasizing the inability of that to provide meaning in and of itself. He emphasizes the value of wisdom, and he once again emphasizes the fear of God. The way one of my commentaries put it is, he wraps up the section by saying, live joyfully, but responsibly. Enjoy what God has given you, but remember, God is the righteous one, and God is watching all that you do. And chapter 11, verses 9 and 10 is where he makes that observation. It says that you who are young, be happy while you're young, and let your hearts give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So then banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. Again, we see him balancing enjoyment with the reminder that, yeah, you can enjoy it, but that's not where your meaning in life is found. Which brings us to chapter 12. And chapter 12 is where he pulls it all together. Chapter 12 is where he gives us the point of the book. After 11 chapters worth of mostly telling us that life is pointless, if you look at it from the perspective under the sun, he gives us where he's going with this. This is his final summary. As he looks back over his life, that he's had the opportunity to experience anything there is to experience, he's done it. He's had wisdom, he's acted foolishly, he's had all the wealth, he's had all the experiences, and here's his final conclusion in chapter 12. Verses 1 through 8, he says, remember God when you're young and healthy. When he says remember has the idea of being guided and influenced by him, of making God a part of your life, of living and following in his ways. And the idea seems to be that doing so in your best days prepares you for advanced age and declining health, when life under the sun begins to seem more and more meaningless. We get to the phase that Solomon is in now as he's writing this. And most of the passage, verses 1 through 8, is kind of a poetic description of old age and dying. Verse 7 refers to the spirit or breath returning to God who gave it, which might be a hint that there is more to life than life under the sun. There's debate on whether that, because it can mean spirit or it can mean merely the breath of life leaving the body. Take it as you will. But verses 9 through 12 then, the second part of his advice as he comes to the point of the book, is to learn from the words of the wise. He says they provide a call to righteousness, refers to them as goads. You know, goads is what you use to poke an animal to make it move. So words of the wise can be a call to action, and they can be a solid resting place. Though he does say that too much studying, especially of things beyond the carefully chosen words of the wise, can be unhealthy and a wearisome thing. And the verse where he talks about how many books cause as much weariness is a favorite verse of Bible college students. But when he talks about too much studying of things being wearisome, he probably has the idea of things like, to put in a modern context, things like, you know, fad books, you know, whatever the latest fad is, where we radically reinterpret the Bible to mean something that no one's ever thought of before, or, you know, arguing over obscure little theological points that don't really have anything to do with the character of God or with our relationship with him. They used to make fun of the medieval theologians for spending hours debating how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Stupid stuff like that. And, you know, some discussions in Bible college get not quite, but almost that stupid. And if you're on the internet and theological circles, yeah, they get that stupid. Which also probably refers to things like, you know, internet rantings and arguments and spending all your time trying to make sure that, you know, everyone knows that they're wrong and you're right. You know, there's an expression, don't feed the trolls. You know, those people who are out there just to argue, don't waste your time. It's weariness. It's making of books without end. Don't bother. But there is the exhortation to learn from the words of the wise, the ones that are carefully chosen and written down for our instruction, for as a call to action for us, as a resting place on which to base our life. And then he comes to the main point, verses 13 and 14, what he's been building to this whole book. You know, verses 13 and 14 is what he really wanted to say, but he had to tell you how he arrived at that point, how he tried out everything in life, and it was all pointless without this realization. And again, let's read verses 13 and 14, last two verses of the book. says, now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. The main point that Solomon wants to make is fear God and keep his commandments, because God does indeed judge the wicked and reward the righteous. If you make anything else the primary focus of your life is going to be pointless. Even if that other focus is a good thing, like a life lived in wisdom, like a loving family, like a fulfilling career, if that is your main focus, life has no point. Because we know that those things are temporary. Those things will all come to an end at our death. And if we make temporary things like that our life's primary focus, doing that only makes sense if we think that when you're dead, you're dead. Living like that only makes sense if we think that this life is all there is. That there's nothing beyond death. That when you die, you go and you rot in the grave and that's it. Our responsibility is to enjoy life, including God's gifts like family and career, good food, all the other things that Solomon lists as enjoyable, but to enjoy those things in the fear and obedience of God. And Solomon here doesn't go into any kind of detail about what comes after this life under the sun. God hasn't really revealed it yet. But his advice is to focus on God, to trust his will and his goodness. Because a life lived for him is not meaningless, even if we don't fully understand its meaning while we live here under the sun. It's really a similar answer to what you get at the end of the book of Job. Job never gets told why all those things happened to him. He just gets told, Job, I'm God, you can trust me. Solomon never comes right out and tells us what meaning there is in life. He tells us plenty of things that aren't the meaning. But he directs us to trust, fear, and obey God. Because he is good, he is righteous, he is loving. And like I said at the start, it's not the nice pat answer that wraps everything up in a nice bow and ties up all the loose ends and makes us feel good about everything. That's what God wants from us. He wants our trust. He wants us to reverence him. You know, and we have an advantage over Solomon because as church-age Christians, we know a lot more about the glorious resurrection, the heavenly home, and the eternal rewards that God has in store for his children. And we can live in light of that. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 11 through 13. It says, since everything will be destroyed, you know, it's kind of going back to Solomon's idea that everything's temporary. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. The day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire. The elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. We know even more clearly than Solomon that life under the sun, this current observable life, is not all that there is. That as we live in fear of the Lord, and again, fear doesn't mean cringing, afraid he's going to smite me. It means the proper reverence and awe, the proper perspective on how great he is and how small and dependent on him we are in comparison. As we live with that perspective, we know what's coming. We know that this life is not all that there is. So the question to ask ourselves from this very different book in the Bible is, do we live in light of the temporary nature of this current life? Do we live in light of the recognition that everything in this life comes to an end? We can enjoy the good things that God gives us, but if they take the highest a higher priority than our relationship with him in terms of obedience, in terms of serving him when you have the opportunity, in terms of spending time with him, if they take a higher priority than that, then we are treating life as something that is meaningless, as something that ends with death and going back to dust in the ground. That's a hopeless perspective. That's a perspective that we as Christians do not have to have, because we have a living hope. We have a secure future in our Lord Jesus Christ.